Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me.
Hi, it's All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Today, the mysteries of our sexy brain. And there's only one explicit reference, and it's coming right now.
When I worked as a clinical neuropsychologist in London, I met a patient who was actually in hospital and I was asked to see him to do a neuropsychological assessment. And when I went up to the ward, the nurse made a comment and said, "You're going to have a good time with him." And I arrived at his bedside and immediately he actually asked me to give him a blowjob. I'm sure I blushed and tried to distract him. And I spent about half an hour with Jack trying to get him to concentrate on my memory tasks and my cognitive assessment. And he was just unstoppable. He had sex on the brain, literally.
Dr. Amy Baird, neuropsychologist from Macquarie University in Sydney, reflecting on one of the pitfalls of studying sex and the brain. She's with me today to share the revealing insights in her recent book, Sex in the Brain, How Your Brain Controls Your Sex Life. Amy Baird, why did you decide to focus your research on sex?
Well, it stemmed really from my PhD research, which was on sexual changes after epilepsy surgery. So when people have brain surgery to cure them of their seizures. And I did that research back in 99 to 2003. And every time I spoke to people about it, they were quite fascinated. And I thought it would make a really interesting popular science book, this topic. But then I moved into other things and I kept sort of accruing cases in my mind as I saw patients who described sexual changes or I read about them in medical journals. And after a couple of decades, I thought, no one else has written this book, maybe I should.
How much do we understand about where our sex drive comes from?
Well, it's quite an under-researched area, really, and a lot of the research that we have learnt this information from comes from animal research. And then also with the progression of neuroimaging, there's been some neuroimaging studies of what happens in the brain when people are sexually aroused or during orgasm. And then, of course, the topic of my book, which is when things go wrong in the brain, such as in brain injury and brain disease, how can that affect people's sex lives? So we get some really unique insights into that relationship when things go wrong in the brain.
Which parts of the brain control our sex life?
So it's really a widespread network. It's not just one structure or one region that controls sex drive and behaviour. So sex is obviously a complicated behaviour. It involves emotion and movement and all sorts of functions. So it's a widespread neural network in the brain. And in the book, I call it the sexual neural network. And it involves cortical regions. So our frontal lobes are quite important in the control of sex drive and behaviour, but also our temporal lobes, some subcortical structures, the basal ganglia, which is involved in reward. So it's really a widespread network. Sex is a good workout for the whole brain, I think.
And a lot of the earlier research was done with animals. Can you tell me about the research that was done in the 1930s on rhesus monkeys?
Yeah, so that was a really important study, actually. The initial scientists who did that research on rhesus monkeys actually did it in 1888. And so they were removing the temporal lobes of monkeys, doing unilateral or one-sided resections and bilateral resections. And they found that when they removed both temporal lobes of monkeys, they developed this syndrome. So after the 1888 work, two scientists in the 1930s, as you say, Kluver and Busey, they were doing this research, and this syndrome called Kluver-Busey syndrome is named after them. And what this syndrome entails is that the monkeys developed different symptoms: visual agnosia, where they couldn't recognise things by sight, hyperorality, where they were exploring things with their mouths, and a number of other symptoms. But the one of interest to me was that they developed hypersexuality, or a dramatic increase in their sex drive and behaviour. And this was both a qualitative change in that they were sort of mounting inanimate objects and doing strange things sexually, but also a quantitative increase in their sexual behaviour. So quite a dramatic change in their behaviour. So it's really the first research that showed us that the temporal lobes in the brain are important in controlling sexual behaviour. And after that research in animals, Kluver-Busey syndrome was then documented in humans.
Why is it that the temporal lobe actually causes this hypersexuality? What else is the temporal lobe responsible for?
Yeah, so, well, in humans, the temporal lobe is important in auditory processing, or, you know, understanding information that we hear, also in comprehending language, in memory. It's quite a rich region of the brain. And in the animal research, what they found was they could actually narrow it down to a structure in the temporal lobe called the amygdala. And it was when the amygdala was damaged that these Kluver-Bucy syndrome symptoms occurred, including hypersexuality. So it was found that really the amygdala was responsible for the hypersexuality.
On All in the Mind, I'm speaking with Dr. Amy Baird about the intricacies of sex and the brain. You did some early research, as you mentioned, on sexuality in relation to working with patients with epilepsy. Then you left it for a while, a long time, and then it was one particular patient that drew you back into this field. Tell me about Jack.
Yeah, so when I worked as a clinical neuropsychologist in London, I met a patient who was actually in hospital. So he was an inpatient and he'd fallen off a roof. He was doing some scaffolding. And in that fall, he had a traumatic brain injury that injured his right frontal lobe. And he was in hospital and I was asked to see him to do a neuropsychological assessment. And that involves assessing people's thinking skills like memory, ability to concentrate and problem solve. And when I went up to the ward, the nurse made a comment and said, "You're going to have a good time with him." And I arrived at his bedside and immediately he propositioned me, actually asked me to give him a blowjob. And I was quite taken aback. I was a pretty junior clinician at that stage. And I'm sure I blushed and tried to distract him. And I spent about half an hour with Jack trying to get him to concentrate on my memory tasks and my cognitive assessment. And he was just unstoppable. He had sex on the brain, literally. He was asking me constantly to perform sexual acts. And I ended up giving up and didn't finish the assessment. So it kind of brought me back, obviously, to my initial PhD research. Jack was really the most extreme case I've ever worked with in terms of his presentation and his constant requesting of sexual acts. I haven't had that before. I've had people since then, you know, kiss my hand or pinch my bum or put their arm around my shoulders or be a bit sexually disinhibited in their language, but not as extreme as Jack.
So Jack had a type of hypersexuality. Was it Kluver-Bucy syndrome?
No, well, I didn't explore the other symptoms of Kluver-Bucy syndrome with him, but his injury was, as I said, to the right frontal lobe. And I felt for his wife. You know, I remember thinking, gosh, I wonder how she's handling this dramatic change in his personality. But I guess my goal was to try to get him through the cognitive assessment. So at that point, I wasn't sort of focused on exploring different aspects of Kluver-Bucy syndrome. But because his injury didn't impact on his temporal lobes and amygdala, I don't feel it was Kluver-Bucy syndrome. It was a hypersexuality driven by his frontal lobe injury.
As you said, your early research into sex and the brain began when you were researching epilepsy. What is the link between epilepsy and when sexuality changes?
Well, interestingly, since antiquity, there's been a sort of link between epilepsy and sex. In the 18th century, neurologists thought epilepsy was caused by sex. Like there was this link between, you know, seizures and sex for a long time. And then it was realised that that's not the case, of course. But in terms of my research, what I found, I interviewed about 70 people who had undergone certain neurosurgery for epilepsy. Some of them had temporal lobe surgery and some had surgery to parts of the brain outside of the temporal lobe. And I found that about half the people I interviewed reported changes in their sex drive after the surgery. The majority reported changes to what they considered to be normal sexual functioning. So prior to the surgery, they were hyposexual or had a lack of interest in sex, which is understandable given that they're having seizures frequently and just not interested in sex at all. So typically the change was to what they felt was normal. But occasionally there was this dramatic hypersexual change where they had a dramatic increase in their sexual thoughts and behaviour to the extent that sometimes partners would say, "I can't keep up with them now, you have to give me the same operation." That was one comment of a partner. And very rarely in the context of hypersexuality there can even be a change in sexual preference.
You mentioned that you work with people with some sort of brain damage to explore sexuality. What are some of the other brain injuries or disorders that have revealed different things about sexuality?
Yeah, so in my work as a clinical neuropsychologist since my PhD, I work clinically and do assessments, and I don't typically ask people about their sex lives. It's not part of a normal neuropsychology assessment, but often it comes up. I spend 3 or 4 hours with my patients, so I think that luxury of time means that they feel comfortable and often raise things that they might not raise with their GP or at other medical appointments. And in the context of, so I've worked now as a neuropsychologist for 15 years, the different conditions that sort of topic has come up in have been stroke, so ruptured brain aneurysms, which have caused a stroke in the brain, Parkinson's disease, dementia. So any sort of neurological condition that impacts on the different parts of the sexual neural network, so the temporal lobes or the frontal lobes, can have an impact on sex drive and behaviour.
I think you worked with one young woman you call Tessa, and she had a brain injury, I think, from a car accident.
That's right.
What happened with her?
Yeah, so she was a passenger in a car driven by her boyfriend, and unfortunately they had an accident and she went through the front windscreen and both frontal lobes were quite severely damaged. But her sort of cognitive functioning and her presentation were quite normal. Her cognitive skills were in the normal range, but her behaviour had changed dramatically and her thoughts about sex in particular. So in taking a history from her and her mother, they described behavioural changes, and Tessa actually, after her mother left the room, said to me, "Every time I meet a guy, I want to have sex with him." In her mind, just that dramatic increase in sexual thoughts was quite dramatic.
You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynne Malcolm. And with me is Dr. Amy Baird, author of Sex in the Brain: How Your Brain Controls Your Sex Life. It explores how sexual desires and behaviours can change radically when something goes wrong through brain injury or disease. She describes some case studies of her patients using pseudonyms. One of them, Terence, had frontotemporal dementia.
Yeah, so frontotemporal dementia, as the word describes, impacts on the frontal lobes. The typical sort of sexual outcome for frontotemporal dementia is actually hyposexuality, or a lack of interest in sex, or a complete absence of sex drive and behaviour. But in rare cases, there can be development of hypersexuality or dramatic increase in sexual thoughts. And in the case of Terence, he started to access pornography and made multiple requests of his wife to have sex multiple times every day, never seemed satisfied, just this dramatic change in thoughts and behaviour. Eventually his wife confided in a friend and said, "This is not the man I married. This is something's going on here." And he was referred to his doctor and neurologist, and it was found that he had behavioural variant of frontotemporal dementia. So as that variation of frontotemporal dementia, the behavioural variant, it impacts on people's behaviour and personality, causes changes in social and emotional behaviours. And as I said, in rare cases, this can impact on sex.
This could affect aged care facilities as well, I guess, if it's happening with dementia.
Absolutely. So there's another case in the book called Isaac, a patient who I saw just last year, actually, and it was a tragic case because Isaac was a resident in an aged care facility. He's in his early 80s, and he was referred quite urgently to me for a neuropsychology assessment by his son because Isaac was charged with sexual assault in the nursing home. He'd actually been found in his neighbour's room with his hands in her underpants. A staff member had found him, and that neighbour had dementia, but at that point they didn't know that Isaac also had dementia. So initially he saw a geriatrician in the process of this charge. He was, you know, looked into medically, but after being charged, the aged care facility sent him to a police station and he was fingerprinted and interviewed by police. The son was called and the son realised that Isaac wasn't answering the policeman's questions appropriately and seemed quite confused. And at that point, they decided to have further medical investigations. The geriatrician raised the question of whether he has dementia. And certainly when I saw him, he did very poorly on the tasks that assess frontal lobe functioning. So he didn't really have any breaks. You know, he was quite disinhibited. He was saying cheeky things to me like, you're a naughty girl. And it was clear that his frontal lobes weren't functioning in a normal way. And I did offer the opinion that he has either behavioural variant frontotemporal dementia or vascular dementia. But nevertheless, the criminal charges stayed and he had an apprehended violence order with his neighbour. So it made it very complicated in the aged care facility. He was essentially confined to his room. He developed bed sores, he became severely depressed, and this case went through the criminal courts for about a year and a half until it was heard. When it was heard, I was in court with Isaac's son, and the magistrate spent 1 minute on it and said, the charges are dropped, he's not fit to be tried. And I wonder how many other cases are going through the criminal courts like Isaac's. You know, sexual disinhibition can occur in the context of any type of cognitive impairment or dementia, and people still have a sex drive when they are elderly and have dementia, and it's a complex issue when they're living in an aged care facility, how to manage this. You know, from all sides of Isaac's case, it was a very difficult issue.
And I guess you get changes in sexuality and, as you said, sexual preference with different disorders. So how much of a challenge is this in the justice system?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really complex issue in the criminal justice system. You know, when there's cases of pedophilia that are caused by, you know, there's another case in my book of right frontal brain tumour that resulted in pedophilia in a man. And it raises really curly questions, you know, about issues of responsibility and how these people should be punished. I mean, there's a clear causative effect in some of these cases when the sexual change disappears, when the tumour is removed. There's a clear causative case too in cases of Parkinson's disease when the medication causes hypersexuality and they stop the medication and all those sexual changes stop. So I think at the moment it's just a case-by-case thing in the criminal courts, but it is a very complex issue that needs further research.
And there are other conditions involving orgasm where orgasm can occur out of the blue. Tell me about some of those.
Yeah, so there's some what we call sexual seizures, which are very rare, but they do occur where orgasm can trigger the seizure or seizures can trigger the orgasm. So it can go either way. And these can be quite pleasurable seizures for people. And, you know, it's more common in women and more common if the seizures arise from the right temporal lobe. So the case studies that have sort of accumulated in the medical literature have shown that pattern. But, you know, it's a pleasurable experience if you have an orgasm associated with a seizure. And often in these case studies that I've read about, women don't want to tell their doctors because they don't want to get rid of the seizures. They're enjoying these, you know, unexpected orgasms. But then if an orgasm precipitates a seizure, that can cause quite a bit of havoc in people's relationships. They can spend their life avoiding having sex, avoiding orgasms because they don't want to have a seizure. So it's sort of two flip sides to how this can have quite a devastating impact on relationships.
And is it the case that aneurysms in the brain can be caused by orgasm?
Well, orgasm can actually trigger the rupturing of a brain aneurysm. So a brain aneurysm is like a small balloon that it's a malformation of a vessel within the brain that can occur in any brain vessel. And that small sort of balloon can burst. And if it does burst, it causes blood to leak into the brain. It's a stroke, essentially, an intracranial hemorrhage. And it's been found that sex can be a trigger for bursting of brain aneurysms. And it's really orgasm because during orgasm, there's a higher blood flow and increase in blood pressure. And what's interesting is that brain aneurysms are more common in women, but the bursting of brain aneurysms during sex occurs more frequently in men. And it occurs more often if the sex is with not your typical partner.
Oh,
yeah, so
strange.
If it's sort of unfaithful sex, if you like, and the reason for that is that the precipitants are sort of physical activity, emotional arousal and stress. And I guess if you're sort of having sex with someone you shouldn't be, that emotional arousal and stress is at a peak level, so to speak.
Are there effective treatments or therapies for people who have these disorders that are causing havoc with their sexuality?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's sex therapists can work with people and offer strategies and so forth, and there's also pharmacological treatments that can be used to treat that. I haven't followed people through long enough to look into treatments, but I know that in some cases of these dramatic changes, things can settle down after a period of time. Sometimes it's just a few months and then things naturally settle down. But in other cases, there needs to be a tampering or a drug treatment, particularly in Parkinson's disease-related hypersexuality, or referral to sex therapists to manage the behaviour.
Are the sex drives of men and women different in relation to what's going on in the brain?
I haven't actually looked into gender differences. I mean, there is this sort of common perception that men have higher sex drives than women and it changes over age. It's not something that I address in my book. Really, the focus for me is when things go wrong in the brain, how does that impact on our sex drive and behaviour? So I'm not sure of the current research on sort of gender differences in sex drive.
And what about what we refer to as sex addiction and addiction to porn? What's known about that and what happens in the brain there?
Yeah, so these are quite controversial conditions that haven't been accepted by medical profession or sex therapy associations. So they're not formally recognised disorders currently. And whether they are true addictions is something that's currently under debate. But in terms of what happens in the brain, there have been some studies looking at people who have, you know, what people call sex addiction or high sex drive and high use of porn, and they have found structural and functional brain differences in these people. But the issue with that research is that we don't know whether it's the porn that has caused those brain changes or whether those brain changes are already present in people and it predisposes them to have a high sex drive or high porn use. So at the moment, we just know that there's differences, but the causal nature of that is unclear.
Where does love come into this discussion? Are there differences in the brain drivers of sex and of love?
Yes, I look into this in a chapter in the book, and there does seem to be an overlap between the sexual neural network and regions of the brain that are involved in love. There have been some brain imaging studies of people who are in love, looking at photos of the person that they're in love with, and they find that those who are in love or out of love have differences in functional brain differences, so differences in the activity, particularly in the left frontal region. So the frontal lobes come up a lot in our discussion. They're pretty crucial in terms of sex and love, actually. And there's also been some really fascinating neuroimaging research which did some scans of people who were in the early stage of love and then followed up 3 years later. And some of those couples had broken up and some were still together. And they actually found differences in the initial brain scans of those who were still together and those who'd broken up. So it seems that these sort of love differences in the brain can actually be almost predictive of whether you're going to stay together or not down the track. But there's only a handful of studies, and I think we need a lot more research on love and the brain.
I have talked to you before about music and the brain. That was a previous area of research for you.
Yes.
Is there a relationship between what you found in your sex research and music and the brain?
The main overlap was a couple who I met in my music research, where the woman had quite severe Alzheimer's dementia, and she went through a period where she had a misidentification delusion where she was unable to recognise her husband of 60 years. She thought he was an intruder. And I write about them in my book, and I interpret that misidentification delusion as like the flip side of love, because it kind of caused her to fall out of love with him. She couldn't even recognise him, even though he was her husband of 60 years. And the way that this delusion was resolved was that they had a song that was playing when they first met. And a very insightful geriatrician suggested to the husband, why don't you find a significant song and play that to her? It might help her to get over this lack of recognition of you. And he started singing Unchained Melody. That was playing when they had their first dance. And he attributes singing that song to her over several days to her recognising him again.
Time goes by.
And that resolved the delusion. So it kind of brought their love back together. I mean, we know that, you know, love songs are crucial in relationships, and certainly it seemed to help them, help this lady, Barbara, overcome her misidentification delusion. So that's really the only overlap in terms of my music and sex research.
So why is sex research so limited? Is there a stigma around it still?
I think there is still a stigma, and I was really surprised when I interviewed an American researcher in my book, Nicole Prowse. She was at UCLA, quite a well-respected university in America, and she is one of the few, if not the only, researcher in the world looking into female orgasm and what goes on in the brain during orgasm. And she does other sort of sex studies as well. And she had a lot of difficulty with ethics committees at the university getting her research through ethics. She was awarded grants and they wouldn't allow her to take up the funding. So there's a controversy that surrounds sex research, and it actually causes the research to not happen. You know, Nicole had to leave the university system in order to progress her research, and she started her own private company. And she said that works because she can continue to collaborate with other researchers at universities and they outsource the controversy to her. So she said, you know, in hindsight, I wish I hadn't focused on sex in my research career because it's been so difficult. So it's amazing that, you know, back in Masters and Johnson's day, there's that TV show that sort of described the difficulties that they had in getting their research. They were real trailblazers in terms of their human sex research, but some of those difficulties are still happening now.
So what do you consider are the biggest questions in this area of research yet to pursue?
I think a big area, and one that fascinated me when I was doing research for this book, is pedophilia. I interviewed a German researcher. In Germany, there's the only treatment centre for pedophilia, for people who have that interest but haven't yet offended. And I think that research is crucial. It's a very traumatic, devastating thing to happen on all sides, victims, offenders. And I think understanding brain differences in pedophiles and what causes people who have that interest to then tick over into actually offending and how we can prevent that is a crucial issue. So this researcher, Till Amelung is his name, he found that when they look at brains of people who have that sexual interest in children but have not yet offended, their brains are different from people who are pedophiles and are in jail for offending. So it seems that there's something goes on in terms of brain changes that trigger offending. And I think that's a really fascinating and frightening area. But, you know, we can't deny that this occurs in our society. This is happening. We need to talk about it more and we need to research it more in order to understand it better to prevent it from happening.
Amy Baird, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Dr. Amy Baird, neuropsychologist at Macquarie University in Sydney and author of Sex in the Brain, which is published by New South. If this program has raised personal concerns for you, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. And head to the All in the Mind website for more links to support.
I need your love.
Thanks to the team, producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Russell Stapleton. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Thanks for joining us. Till next time.